Good morning, everybody. You hear me okay? Good.
Morning.
All right, we have a quorum, so I'm going to get started since it's 10 o'clock. No, Mitch isn't able to attend today. Everybody else is here. So, good morning. I'd like to call the May 19th Pension Committee to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the February 17th, 2022 minutes. Were there any questions or concerns of those minutes? Okay, hearing none, they will stand approved. All right, and the next item is an update on the pension and OPEB performance. We have Mr. Pat Wing here with Marpet and Associates, and I'm going to turn it over to him.
All right, great. Thank you, Gina, and good morning again, everyone.
I can hear you, Pat. And others hear you?
Can everybody else hear me?
I can hear them.
Yes.
Yes.
You can't hear me, Gina?
Hold on.
That's all right.
I can hear you, Pat.
We tested this earlier and it worked. Bobby and I did this together. Hold on.
Okay.
I'm fine.
You can hear him. I know. I'm the only one that can't hear him. It's just me. Bobby and I tested.
Does that, I don't know if that makes Gina the lucky one then. I'm not sure.
Yeah. You have volume all the way up. All right, Pat, can you say something?
Good morning, Gina.
Yeah, it's just really faint. Oh, yeah. Okay, we're good.
You can hear me at least a little bit?
Not yeah, fine. I'm good.
All right. Well, good morning again, everyone. So we have our typical agenda this morning, a review of the Q1 performance for both funds and as well as a performance update through April. So we'll take a similar approach that we did in our February meeting when we spent a little bit more time on the market environment than we typically do. Markets have been challenging, to put it mildly, as I'm sure you all well know, so far this year. So I want to weave in some commentary in that market environment, not just about, you know, what's going on in the economy and capital markets, but also how that's impacting our thinking and positioning of both of the funds as well. So with that said, just bear with me quickly as I share my screen here. Let's see here. Okay, can everybody see my screen? Okay, great. So as I said, we'll start where we always do with the market environment. And please note, if anybody has any questions, I can only see a few of you in the window pane to the side. So I'll try to be thoughtful about pausing as I work through the materials here. And if I don't do a good job at that, please just jump in and ask any questions along the way. Or obviously at the end of the presentation, happy to answer any questions that the committee or anybody else on the call has. So with that said, from a U.S. economic perspective, let's start at a high level and then we'll break things down a little bit more granularly. But this chart up to the top right should be fairly familiar to you all. It's really a staple of our market environment reports where we're just looking at real GDP or economic growth within the U.S. These bars are the quarterly numbers. The striped bars towards the end are economists' estimates for the rest of 2022. And the orange line is the year-over-year number. But if we take a look at the last fully colored in bar right here, you'll note that it's actually below zero. So economic growth in Q1 came in well below economists' expectations. They were expecting pretty mild but positive growth of about 1.5%, but it actually showed a decline in economic growth of about 1.4%. Now, interestingly, when you take a look under the hood and look at some of the details, we'd argue that the headline number wasn't nearly as bad as it would seem at first glance. And we note a couple of those items in the first bullet point. Consumer spending actually was a little bit better or a little bit higher than Q4. And as you all well know, the consumers make up a large portion, about 2/3 to 70% of the overall US economy. But what really, there were two major factors that were drags on economic growth. One being net exports, and the second being a slowdown in private inventory investment. And those two combined actually detracted, as you see here, more than 4 percentage points off of that headline number. So in other words, absent those two factors, growth would have been actually positive 2.5%. Now, obviously, they're a part of the calculation, so we can't exclude them. But I'm noting this because there were some unique headwinds to those key factors in Q1, which should alleviate, at least as we head into the middle of this year. If we think about net exports, that was a huge drag. Our trade with China came down quite notably during the quarter, particularly our exports, as there have been major lockdowns in the country. As you know, a country like, or a city like Shanghai, of the $25 to $30 million residents have basically been locked in their houses for the past month. So economic activity, including what they're importing from abroad, has slowed fairly dramatically. So as we look ahead here, you know, the China lockdowns are still in place, but importantly in Shanghai, they've gone a few days now without any new COVID cases. So hopefully, at least for the Chinese people themselves, they those lockdowns are lifted, which would then help their economic growth. And then therefore, our exports to China should pick up in the back half of this year. And then as far as private inventory investment is related, this is very cyclical in the short term. So when we look back at this Q4 economic growth number, which was about 7%, private inventory investment accounted for 5 percentage points of that 7%. So it was a massive contributor. And then in Q1, it was a big detractor. So it is very cyclical in the short term. So it was a tailwind, turned into a big headwind. So now it's more likely than not to turn into a tailwind, at least in the middle part of this year. Now, that said, as you look at these striped bars, economist estimates call for a growth to rebound slightly, but we'll call it steady or moderate growth. However, we'd argue that the range of outcomes is pretty wide right now and probably skewed to the downside for a few factors that we outline here, namely the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, the impact that's had on Europe and commodity and food prices, the zero COVID policy in China that I mentioned a second ago, and then inflation. And as it relates to inflation within the U.S. economy, it's triggered a huge shift in the outlook for Federal Reserve policy that we note in this final bullet point. And I'll just sum it up here. What we've seen so far from the Fed is that they've raised short-term interest rates off of zero by about 0.75 percentage points so far. It's looking likely that they do another 0.5 percentage point in June and again in July. And right now, markets are pricing in a short-term interest rate of around 3%. By year end. Now that 3% isn't considerably high by historical levels, but the speed and the magnitude of their hiking cycle is something that we haven't seen since the mid 90s. So economists and investors particularly are come concerned right now that clearly the economy has slowed. The Fed is pumping on the brakes to try and rein in inflation. In order to do that, they have to slow the economy further. So the key question that we'll talk about on the next page really is, can they engineer sort of a soft landing or just this little slowdown and then reaccelerate perhaps maybe in the first half of next year? Or are they going to pump too hard and too fast and cause the economy to slow even further and tip us into a recession? So in order to discern, you know, which of those outcomes is going to take place, we're looking at a number of things. Perhaps most importantly, yield curve spreads. I'm sure some of you know there was a lot of rhetoric around this towards the end of Q1 and the beginning of April, that key parts of the Treasury yield curve have become inverted. So in other words, shorter dated maturities were yielding more than their longer term counterparts. And at least history would suggest that that is a poor economic omen. Now, admittedly, sometimes it does send false signals, but more often than not, it tends to be a decent predictor of a recession, maybe in the coming 15, 18 months from that initial inversion. So just to illustrate those comments, you can see the blue line in the top right chart here. This is that 10 minus 2 year spread. And you can see these kind of shaded bars are indicative of periods of recession. And again, when that spread goes negative, more often than not, a recession follows. Now, again, there have been some false signals here. You can see in the mid 90s period, but more recently, that inversion that spread came close to inverting at the end of the first quarter. It has since re-steepened a little bit. So it has a positive spread now of about 0.25 percentage point. But at the same time, there are other parts of the curve that are sending a different signal. So we're showing a different spread here in the lighter color line, the 10-year minus the 3-month, which historically is you know, trended in the same direction. You know, the absolute level has been different, but the trend's usually consistent. However, in the beginning of this year, while the 10 year minus the 2 year declined rather notably, the 10 year minus the 3 month steepened rather notably. So we are getting conflicting signals from the yield curve right now. If we saw the 10 year minus the 3 year flatten, as we saw in the case with the 10 minus the 2 year, then that would give us more confirmation that this economic weakness that we're seeing is going to perhaps become more protracted. Now, that said, when we look at some other economic indicators, they would also argue we're sort of in the latter stages of the economic cycle, which is surprising to some degree, right? We're only 2 years into this recovery. But since the policy response was so front-loaded coming out of the pandemic, it's sort of leading to a shorter cycle than we've seen in a few decades. So when we look at some of these indicators, most notably consumer confidence, it's giving us a similar signal to the 10 year minus the 2 year spread. So when you look at the bottom chart here, this green line, what this is showing is the consumer expectations for the future economy, less their take on current conditions. So if the green line is positive, they expect the economic outlook to improve and vice versa. And you can see below, this is well below zero. So in other words, consumers expect the economy to deteriorate relative to their take on the economy's current conditions. And the level we're at right now, again, is consistent with historical recessions. You can see here in these shaded bars. So again, as we look forward, what we're monitoring, number one, again, the yield curve, just given its strong signals in the past. But again, some of these other key economic data that are consistent with a late cycle economy. One of the things where we haven't seen too many red flags yet is unemployment claims. That's usually where you need to look in the labor market for signs of an economic contraction. The unemployment rate itself and the monthly job numbers are what's called a lagging economic indicator. Just think, you know, how long it takes for you to post or a firm to post a job and then for actually to be filled could be months in advance. So it's somewhat lagging. Those weekly jobless claims that come out every Thursday are more of a real-time indicator. They have ticked up slightly recently, but they're well below historical levels. And if we see that number jump, that's going to give us further confirmation that the economy is probably set to weaken in the back half of this year. Now, with that said, if we take a look at things from a global perspective, it's similar to the US. However, things have deteriorated, I would argue, more rapidly. If you look at Europe, you can see consumer confidence there absolutely fell off a cliff so far here in Q1. Inflation certainly playing a role there. The Russian invasion of the Ukraine also probably impacting consumer confidence. And then in China as well, you can see economic activity deteriorating notably most recently. This is a measure of really their manufacturing and services sector. And when this line is below 50, it's consistent with an economic contraction. And that's really due, again, to the zero COVID policy. So when we think about growth, not just in the US, but outside the US, we probably argue that outside the US, there might be some places that are actually in recession right now. But importantly, if we do see some easing in that China COVID policy, then we could see an acceleration in Chinese economic growth in the back half of the year, which would also be helpful for Europe, because Europe is actually a bigger trading partner with China than the US is. So in other words, the US economy seems set to continue to be relatively weak here, but if we have a reacceleration outside the US in the back half, that could be helpful for global economic growth and offset some of the weakness that we're seeing in the US. Now, with all that said, so what did that mean for markets in the first quarter? You can see the green bars on this chart are the Q1 numbers. The darker bars are the one-year numbers from March of last year through the end of March of this year. As far as equity perspective, you can see U.S. equities and international developed equities both declined a little bit more than 5%. Emerging market equities were down a little bit more than their international developed counterparts. And then interestingly, U.S. bonds here, you can see down almost 6%. So that's a little bit of a historical anomaly. Typically, when equities are under pressure, bonds are sort of the ballast or the downside protector in the portfolio. However, we had a case where the tail was sort of wagging the dog here, In other words, as the Fed began raising rates and intimated that they were going to continue to raise rates quite quickly, yields across other maturities, the intermediate and the longer term maturities, rose as well. And when rates go up, bond prices come down. So that put pressure on the fixed income markets and also some pressure on the equity markets. Now, importantly for the two funds, I wanted to point out that this index that we're showing here is the Barclays Aggregate Bond Index, which has a longer duration or more interest rate risk than the benchmark we use in the two funds. The latter is the Intermediate Government Credit Index, which has a much lower duration or less interest rate risk. So in other words, when rates move, it impacts the benchmark within the two funds less so. So in other words, the benchmark for the two funds wasn't down 5.9%. It was only down 4.5%. And as we'll see shortly, the fixed income investments within the portfolio actually were down less than that. So we had some downside protection, some outperformance within fixed income. Now, importantly, you see here equities under pressure, bonds under pressure. But in the inflationary environment, you know, we have real estate in the funds and infrastructure that was funded in the beginning of the year. And in that inflationary environment, we would expect those asset classes to do well, and they did just that. So as we'll show here shortly, real estate was up close to 7%, and infrastructure was also up around 2%. So as I talked about in February, we were a little bit fortuitous with the timing of that infrastructure investment at the very beginning of the year, where that money was sourced from both equities and fixed income, which were under a lot of pressure in Q1. Whereas infrastructure was positive. So again, a little bit timing as far as that timing went, where we essentially reduced the allocations to equities and fixed income before the end of the year to meet the infrastructure investment that was due at the beginning of the year. So with that said, a couple other quick comments here before I'll pause and then we'll jump into the data itself. We always like to take a look under the hood in the U.S. equity market to see where the themes are and help us give more context for how some of the managers did within the respective funds. So from a sector perspective, which is this top chart, the lighter bars are the Q1 numbers. You can see as you work your way from top to bottom here, most sectors were in the red. There were two exceptions. One notable one, energy, was actually up almost 40%, as you can see here on the back of surging oil prices. Oil prices skyrocketed through the roof, really due to supply concerns, again, from disruptions in the Russian invasion of the Ukraine. And then obviously European and US sanctions against Russia and some banning of their of oil imports from Russia as well. So energy surged amid that environment. The other sector that posted a small gain was utilities, just more of a defensive sector that usually does well amid a challenging equity market environment. Now, importantly for the two funds, as we note in the second bullet point, value stocks outperformed growth stocks for the first time in a year amid rising rates. And I mentioned that latter point because as rates were stable or declining really over the past 3, 5, 7, 10 years, that was really a tailwind for growth stocks relative to value. But as rates surged in Q1, that script was flipped and value was about 10 percentage points ahead of growth stocks. So we do have tilts towards value stocks within the US and non-US equities. Number one, because they're cheap on a relative basis. And number two, in anticipation that rates could rise and feeling that that would be a tailwind for value relative to growth. So those tilts were helpful for the funds. And finally, before I wrap up here, I want to provide a little bit more context around equity market returns after the initial yield curve inversion. So we talked about them from an economic perspective. But interestingly, there's some data in this bottom chart that we sourced from Morgan Stanley showing the average returns of various equity markets after the initial yield curve inversion. So this time around, it occurred early in April. But historically, it necessarily hasn't been a poor sign for equities, at least in the short term. You can see the average returns after the 5 or 6 episodes since the late 70s, equities globally in the first line, US, the S&P 500, and then you see international developed equities in Europe, Japan, and the UK, and then finally emerging markets, generally slightly positive in the short term, you know, kind of around the flat line, but in the 12-month period after that initial inversion, gains were relatively strong. So global equities on average up 12%, S&P on average around 16.5, positive returns from non-US developed markets, and then stronger returns from MSCI emerging market stocks. So it is important to remember that, you know, the economy is not the market and vice versa. The market does anticipate the economy, say with, you know, a 9-12 month in advance. However, at least historically, despite the fact that we've seen more weakness in Q2 after that initial inversion, certainly history would argue that if we do manage to skirt or sort of delay a recession, that the back half of this year may be a little bit more favorable than what we've seen in the first half. And admittedly, the bar is quite low. So before I move into and talk about some of the performance and asset allocation and positioning and what we're thinking, let me pause here to see if the committee has any questions as it relates to the market environment. Okay. So let's jump in and we'll cover the pension in detail, and then we'll just hit a few key items on the OPEB because they're invested pretty much identically. So the market value for the pension at the end of March was $152.7 million. In the first quarter, we did have an investment loss of $6.2 million given the performance of equities and fixed income that I showed earlier. And the fund had a return of down 3.9%, slightly ahead of the policy index per the investment policy statement that was down 4%. And I'll talk about the drivers of those differences in just a second. Importantly, for the fiscal year, at least through March, and we'll give you an update again when we talk about April here a little bit later, through March, we still had a positive number. So an investment gain of $1.7 million, a return of 1.1% net of fees, which was about 0.4 percentage points ahead of that policy benchmark. Now, as far as the quarter was concerned, what was helpful for the fund relative to that benchmark? So what drove this slight outperformance? Number one, asset allocation, as I'll show shortly. We were underweight equities in the first quarter, underweight fixed income, and overweight those inflation-sensitive assets in real estate and infrastructure, given the economic environment was highly inflationary. So that was helpful. The value tilt that I spoke to within U.S. and non-U.S. equities, and then outperformance by the fixed income managers. Now, what offset that slightly was an emerging markets overweight within non-U.S. equities. So I talked about earlier how emerging market stocks were slightly behind their developed non-US counterparts. We have a little bit more money in emerging markets than the benchmark, mainly due because they have very, very attractive valuations, which tend not to matter in the short term, quarter in, quarter out. But over the intermediate and long term, buying what's cheap usually outperforms something that is expensive. So we continue to maintain that slight overweight and are going to be pretty patient to wait for that to pay off in the intermediate term here. And then the other driver was private infrastructure underperformance. So even though it posted an absolute return positive during the quarter, the benchmark for that allocation is inflation plus 4%. And since inflation was incredibly high during the quarter, the infrastructure was up around 2%, but the benchmark was up 4% given inflation was so high. So it underperformed slightly, causing a little bit of a drag on the fund relative to the benchmark. So as far as the data itself, we'll take a look at, you know, a high level of a few key metrics here, and then we'll dig a little bit more deeply. So we began the year, you can see up here, $158.8 million. The cash flows were negligible. So the fund essentially decreased by about $6.17 million, that investment loss at the end of Q1. Now I'll talk more about these returns in just a second when we look at them from a peer rankings perspective. But before doing though, just to illustrate my comments around the respective over and underweights, you can see the current allocations as of the quarter end for equities relative to their targets. So we were a little bit overweight in the US, but that was offset by an underweight in global, and then more so by an underweight to non-US. So in aggregate, we're underweight equities moving into Q2, which has been helpful as equity markets have continued their downtrend. As far as the overweight to inflation sensitive assets, you can see that here with real estate and infrastructure in aggregate, about 1.5 percentage points overweight relative to that index. So obviously that some of that overweight came from the underweight to equities and the residual coming from an underweight to fixed income and cash combined. But then importantly, everything's still within the range per the council approved investment policy statement. So with that said, let's take a look now at those peer rankings. So again, just as a quick reminder, and I know you've all heard this many, many times, but we use a third-party platform to put together these reports. So it gives us an opportunity, since many other firms use it, to really compare and contrast how the fund is doing relative to other public defined benefit funds in this universe. And you can see all the various time periods across the chart here. And then the number of portfolios, or the number of funds in this third row from the bottom. So almost more than 400 in most of these time periods. So it's a very robust sample set. So as far as the Q1 numbers, those are here again. You'll recognize the numbers I talked about a second ago. So even though the number was negative of 3.9% during the quarter, that was actually good for top 19% relative to all the other public funds in this database. So in other words, the fund did better than 81% of these 430 funds that were in here during the quarter. It's a similar story for the fiscal year to date. You can see up 1.1 versus 0.7 in top 15, similar story for 1 year. And then as you work your way left to right for the intermediate periods, not necessarily quite as good from a relative ranking perspective, but still comfortably ahead of that median. So this period was obviously a strong period for equity markets. So, you know, the fund had given up a little bit on the upside in those very, very strong markets. But what really has been helpful over the past year is really the downside protection. When things have gotten bad from an equity market perspective and even fixed income, being invested a little bit more conservatively, not just relative to the benchmark, but also relative to many of the other public funds out there. So with that said, let me make a few comments about some of the investment managers here, and then we'll talk about the OPEB, wrap up with the update, and I'll spend some time talking about our outlook. So as far as this page is concerned, we show the returns, not just for the total fund up top that we showed a second ago on the peer rankings page, but then for the individual asset classes. And so you can see the total equity composite, or total equity asset class, a weighted average of the U.S., global, and non-U.S. equities, was slightly ahead of the benchmark, really driven by outperformance within the U.S. So what was helpful really, again, was this dedicated allocation to value stocks, particularly small cap value stocks, that were only down 1.2% versus the broad market that was down 5.3%. So again, having that value tilt in anticipation of rising rates, and coupled with the fact that value is cheap relative to growth, provided some downside protection for US equities during the quarter. You'd see the global equities here in aggregate, you know, pretty much in line with the respective benchmarks, so not too much to discuss there. But as I mentioned earlier, you can see in the non-US equity space, it was in line with the benchmark. So whereas I mentioned the emerging markets overweight was a little bit of a headwind from a relative perspective, having a value tilt through Schroders here, you can see Schroder International Multicap Value Trust was helpful. Even though they were slightly behind their benchmark, you can see value stocks outside the US were almost flat during the quarter, well ahead of the broad non-US market, and therefore well ahead of growth stocks as well. So again, value helpful in the US and non-US markets. In real estate, you can see this below, as I mentioned, clearing up a little under 7% during the quarter, a little bit behind their benchmark, but again, a very, very strong return relative to all other asset classes, really, or really fixed income and equities during the quarter. And then infrastructure here as well, up a little bit more than 2%. Again, you can see that CPI plus 4% was 4.1% during the quarter, which if you think about it, you know, prior to this massive inflation that we're seeing, it, you know, CPI plus 4% for a whole year would usually be around 6%. But we saw it come in at 4.1% just for the first quarter because inflation continues to accelerate here. Now, importantly, we did add a manager in the first quarter. You can see Cohen and Steers here is a listed infrastructure manager. So they're buying and selling the stocks of companies that own and operate infrastructure assets, really to pair it with the private piece and to get us to be a little bit overweight that asset class. You can see here 5.2 versus the target of 5%. And actually infrastructure stocks, you can see since it was added at the end of January, posted a gain of 7%. So having infrastructure, not just on the private side, but also the public side, was very helpful since global equities were down about 5% in aggregate, as I showed earlier. And then within fixed income, just to wrap up the pension here, as I mentioned earlier, the benchmark that we're using was only down 4.5%. Again, has less interest rate risk than that benchmark we showed in the market environment report. But then the managers within the fixed income portfolio were outperforming that benchmark. You could see the fixed income allocation just down 4.2 versus 4.5, as Wilmington Trust actually had a very good quarter. You know, they're much more conservative than your typical fixed income manager, so we would expect them to do well, at least on a relative basis during the quarter, and they did just that. So since they make up about half of the allocation to fixed income and they were down 4.2 versus 4.5, if we just think about this as as an accounting identity, then that means the three other managers in aggregate were down 4.2 versus 4.5 for the benchmark. As you can see, two of the active managers, Lord Abbett number one and then Chartwell number two, outperforming their respective benchmarks. So with that said, let me jump into the OPEB here, and we'll do this more quickly because, again, it's invested pretty much the same as the pension, and then we'll get into the update and finish up with the outlook. So as far as the OPEB is concerned, we ended March at about $61.1 million. There was an investment loss of about $2.5 million, but the return, again, was pretty much in line with the pension since they're invested pretty much identically. The only differences will really be due to any cash flows or marginal rebalancing. Again, like the pension, as far as the fiscal year is concerned, still positive at least through March, and a return of 1% versus that policy index of 0.7%. And then again, the drivers of the differences between the fund return and the benchmark follow suit with that of the pension. So from a high level perspective, again, just talking about some of the cash flows, returns, and asset allocation, you can see where we were at the beginning of the year was $63.6 million. Cash outflow was negligible. So basically the fund declined by that investment loss of about $2.5 million. Again, we'll dig in the returns here in just a second from that peer perspective, but I wanted to point out, similar to the pension, we're underweight equities in aggregate. You can see at the end of the quarter, a little bit overweight in the US, more than offset by an underweight in global, and then an additional underweight in non-US equities. So again, about a half a percentage point underweight equities as we headed into Q2, with a decent overweight to those inflation sensitive assets. These data actually mirror the pension exactly from a percentage point perspective. And then again, since we have a decent overweight there, some of that is coming from equities, and additionally from fixed income, which again has been helpful so far quarter to date, because this Q2 has looked a lot like what we saw so far here in Q1. So we'll wrap up here on the rankings page, and the numbers are gonna look very similar, obviously, to those of the pension. And you can see for the quarter, again, even though we're down 3.9%, it was good pretty much for the top quintile there, top 21%. So basically the same as the pension. Fiscal year to date, still positive there, top quintile, 1 year, similar story. And then the takeaways from those intermediate and longer term returns follow suit to my comments that I've made around the pension. So with all that said, again, please let me pause here quickly before we shift gears and wrap up with the performance update. And I'll talk a little bit more about the outlook and positioning. Okay. So bear with me for a quick second here as I switch the reports. Here we go. Okay, so here we see a performance update through April. So as you can see, let me just highlight something here quickly. April was similar from a theme and a relative performance perspective that we saw in Q1. So again, value doing better than growth, equities under pressure, not just in the US and non-US, fixed income also under pressure still. But the relative performance, at least for the fund itself, was slightly better than what we saw in Q1. So you can see the total fund for the pension down 5.5%, about 0.3 percentage points ahead of that benchmark. For the fiscal year, we're now down 4.4, a little bit ahead of that benchmark. And I want to take a quick second there to pause. Now, as you all know, from an actuarial perspective, Chiron uses the five-year smoothing approach. So if we do come in below the assumed rate of return in this current fiscal year, which appears very likely, we do have gains in the bank that haven't been recognized yet. So in other words, in the previous four fiscal years, two of them were slightly below the assumed rate of return. One was comfortably above, and then in the past fiscal year, we were almost four times the assumed rate of return. So if we do come in below, some of those gains haven't been recognized yet, so it will offset some of the loss here from an actuarial perspective. In other words, the return coming in below that assumed rate of return. Now, with that said, as far as the quarter's concerned, again, similar story. Equities were a little bit ahead of the game. The weighted average of the U.S. global and non-U.S. similar story, where U.S. equities were decently ahead of the benchmark, again, because value stocks, even though they were in the red, were ahead of the broad market. The global equity managers were getting, once again, more or less in line with their benchmark, where non-U.S. equities were slightly behind during the quarter. So really the U.S. equity allocation driving the outperformance for the total equity composite. Now, as we continue to head into the May period here, the underweights to equities, we've increased them, not just through market performance, but also through some rebalancing. So as we headed into the quarter, we're about a half a percentage point underweight equities, but we ended April about 2 percentage point underweight equities, as we continue to think the short-term outlook was pretty muddied as we headed into the new month. We continue to maintain that overweight to real estate and infrastructure. You can see here it's increased from about 1.5 percentage points at the end of Q1 to now north of 2 percentage points combined when you look at the real estate overweight and the infrastructure overweight. Now, we don't have any April numbers for Clarion yet, but some real estate managers do put out monthly numbers, and what we've seen, they continue to be positive. The few that have come in have been north of 1% in April. So again, those themes that we saw in Q1 have continued here so far in Q2 from those inflation-sensitive assets doing better. You can see the infrastructure was showing a slightly negative return here. We don't have the private infrastructure returns yet, but the listed infrastructure was actually negative in April rather than positive in Q1. However, it was well north of global equities. You can see it was down about 4%, whereas global equities are down around 8% here. You can see the benchmark for the global equity managers. So at least providing some downside protection relative to the global markets. And then finally, fixed income, you can see a little bit ahead of the game here as well, similar to Q1, Wilmington Trust, a little bit of ahead. And therefore, the combination of the other three managers a little bit ahead as well. And fixed income still a little bit below the target when you take into account fixed income and cash. So when we think about the overweights and the underweights respectively, as we headed into April, we become more underweight equities than we were at the end of Q1, an increased overweight to those inflation-sensitive assets. And the fixed income underweight has decreased a little bit because if we do see that economic weakness in the second half of the year, we think it's more likely than not that rates maybe have at the minimum stabilized. So in other words, they may not decline from here, which is typically the case in an economic recession. But even though the Fed is raising short-term rates, that's what they control. They don't control necessarily intermediate and longer-term rates, which typically move based on what the economy is doing. So that underweight to fixed income and cash in aggregate has decreased at the end of the quarter. At the end of April, excuse me. Now for the OPEB, it's a similar story, so I won't walk through the granularity, but just want to point out the total fund returns here. You can see down 5.5%, so similar to the pension during the quarter and the fiscal year. So as we pause here and think about, you know, things moving ahead, I just want to address a couple of key issues and then I'll wrap up. So as you can see from the numbers in April, and I'm sure if those of you following in May, May's been challenging to say the least. Took a quick look at some estimates for May. The fund continues to outperform on a relative basis, given its more defensive posture. And as far as what we're looking for, in addition to the economic indicators I talked about earlier, some market indicators as well, you know, tend to give us an early sign of any bottom in the equity markets. And we also have to have some historical context. And what I mean by that is when we look at the post-World War II period, the average equity bear market, if you will, is around 32%. Now, that average is deeper or worse when it's consistent or those bear markets have occurred amid an economic recession. Outside of a recession, the average decline is probably around 23-24%. So we're almost there at that point. That's why this key question is whether, you know, how the economy is going to unfold in the back half of this year. If we do see that economic data come in a little bit better, we'll also be looking at markets for initial signs that the back half of this year may be a little bit more, again, a little bit better than the first half. And again, admittedly, the bar is low, but things we'll be looking at is really high yield spreads are a good indicator for equity markets. In other words, when spreads are coming in or stabilizing, or the additional yield relative to safe treasury bonds is stabilizing, that's generally a good indicator that, you know, more calm is coming to the equity markets. You know, it's historically said that credit leads and equity follows, so we continue to monitor that closely. And then the yield curve as well. If we see a stabilization in the yield curve where those spreads remain positive as opposed to reinverting, then that'll give us another sign that maybe the back half of the year is going to be better than the first half and maybe positive in the Q3 and Q4. So that are some of the things that we're looking at in order to determine the outlook for markets in the back half of this year. But as things stand here today, as I talked about a second ago, we continue to be underweight equities. We raised the allocation, but are still underweight fixed income and have those overweights to the inflation sensitive assets. Now, sometimes as I wrap up here, just wanted to make a quick comment. You know, sometimes we get the question of, you know, why aren't we, you know, all in cash, right? Or why don't we have, you know, just 20% in equities and all in fixed income? So there's some challenges with doing that for a public defined benefit fund, because what you'll find is the asset allocation has to be reasonably consistent with the assumed rate of return. In other words, if we had an allocation of sort of 20 equities and 80 fixed income, that's not consistent with that target rate of return, and the actuary could come back, and we've seen this elsewhere, say your asset allocation, you're not going to get anywhere close to your assumed rate of return. You need to lower that return, which obviously has budgetary implication because it would increase the liability and increase your unfunded liability, which then the county would have to make up in contributions. So that's one angle. And the second angle is, you know, you have to be very careful and thoughtful about having huge underweights or huge overweights in any one particular area. You know, market timing is a very, very dangerous game, right? Because people think usually you have to get one decision right, you know, when to get out or whether when to get in. But it's actually two decisions: when to get out and when to get back in, or when to get in and when to get out. So since the decision is actually twofold, not onefold, then the number of decisions you have to get right is higher. So the probability that you get them both right is lower. So we're, again, very careful and try to be very thoughtful with that in the back of our minds, taking into account the economic environment, taking into account the market indicators, and making tweaks, making tilts as appropriate based on what we're seeing in the economy and capital markets, which has at least paid off on a relative basis to this benchmark and other public funds out there, although markets haven't necessarily afforded us the opportunity to hit that assumed rate of return for the current fiscal year. So with all that said, I know it ran a little bit longer than usual, but wanted to make those comments around the markets, the economy, and what we're thinking. So please, again, let me pause here. Happy to answer any questions or comments from the committee.
Well, thank you for all the good news. We appreciate it, Pat. Can you guys hear me? You all hear me? Okay. I guess the recommendation then, looking at your other slides, is just hold tight. You're wait until November. I mean, it's scary for me on this end watching us lose money.
That's the recommendation. I think we should follow suit for what we did before, right? Or what we've done historically is after the actuary comes in and gives us that update on where the health of the fund is, then review the asset allocation. I think when we're going to be sitting here, and we don't know this for certain, in February when we normally do that, that it's likely markets are going to at least recover somewhat from where we are now. So in other words, the other key point to that question, Gina, is we have to remember that this fund operates in perpetuity, right? We have a long-term time horizon here. We don't have a lot of negative cash flows. In other words, money coming out of the fund, and that's a big risk for more mature or a lot of other plans out there. If they have negative cash flows to the tune of 3-4%, then it increases the risk of having to sell something at the wrong time, which then impairs that money, right? You once you sold it, it can't recover. Since we don't have that here, it allows us to, you know, really take that longer term view, that longer term horizon. So to your point, is well taken that it's been a difficult environment to say the least at a minimum, but we have to keep in the back of our mind that this plans or these plans operate in perpetuity. And since we don't have those negative cash flows, as hard as it is to see the volatility, and I'm using that loosely here, should be able to tolerate it because we're not taking money out of the funds. So my recommendation, at least now, would be to sit tight and really follow suit with our historical pattern of doing that review after the actuarial presentation. Unless anybody feels differently, if you do, we could, you know, certainly do it sooner as well. We're happy to do that, but if that would be at least our recommendation, that, you know, we're confident in waiting till February to take a look at things.
We will ask for a drawdown. It'll be over $1 million, but it won't be $2 million. Is coming next month.
Just out of the pension?
Jean? Out of the pension. We do have a little bit of a drawdown coming. Percentage-wise, it's not significant, but to keep that in the back of mind where you're going to take it.
Okay, that's helpful. Now, when would that money need to be available, Gina? Just maybe the last week in June or before that?
No, last week of June is fine, as long as it's by June 30. Okay. And I will have a good number to you by, I would say, in 2 weeks.
Okay.
But just to think about that as you're watching your markets.
Yes, thank you for that information.
Does anybody else have any questions? Okay, not hearing any. Again, thank you, Pat.
Well,
appreciate it. Hopefully the news will be better next quarter. All right, can I have a time to adjourn? So can I have a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Can I have a motion and a second? Second. I have a second. I believe that was Kathy. Thank you. All in favor, say aye.
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 Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Take care.